It's easy to assume that everything is fine with our pets, but like they say, an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound of cure. And when it comes to preventing obesity, we mean that literally. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes some time each month to spend with us to give us some advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Oh, it's nice to be here again.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about obsessive compulsive disorder. We have it in humans.
Yeah. And guess what? We have it in pets. We don't know about the obsessive stuff because they can't tell us what they're thinking. So typically we'll call it like canine compulsive disorder or feline compulsive disorder. But we do see it. And there was just a study out recently where they were looking at MRI studies, magnetic resonance imaging studies of Dobermans that have been identified with compulsive disorders. And, you know, different breeds kind of have their own things that they do. And one of the things that we'll see in Dobermans is something called flank sucking, where they'll turn and they'll just put their flank in their mouth and just suck away. Or we'll also see them spinning and doing almost like a tail chasing, even though they don't have a tail. Very common to see things like that happening. And guess what? They're MRI studies were identical to in the same brain areas were affected as it is in people.
Ah.
And, you know, it's when you talk to people that have problems with compulsive disorders, a lot of people will say, yes, stress really brings it on. And guess what? We find the same thing with our pets, too. You know, things like golden retrievers that don't like to be left alone because their family members have to leave. And what they will do is just sit and start licking and licking and licking a spot on their leg, and they'll start self-mutilating. And we'll sometimes call those lick granulomas. I just had a German Shepherd in the exam room the other day that is a tail chaser. And whenever the dog gets upset, it just goes into this frenzy of spinning out of control to the point where it actually hit its head on the bench, kind of shook itself, and then just kept spinning again because it was nervous about being at the vet school. So, you know, some of these dogs, if we can identify what the stressors are, dealing with the underlying problem may help get under control. But for many dogs, especially if they're self-mutilating or it's controlling their life, we're often looking at medical management, and we use the same drugs that are used in people, things like fluoxetine or Prozac and some of the other drugs in that line are very, very commonly used. And I think this is one of those things where if you have a pet that has a behavior that's very repetitive, then, you know, talk to your vet about it. There may be something that we can do about it to improve not only the dog's quality of life, but the owner's quality of life.
But your own as well,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Are all animals susceptible to it?
They are. It tends to be, it may be genetic. It may run in families. I don't see that many mixed breed dogs that do this, but so that's why you start wondering if when you start getting these like smaller populations of dogs that are being bred, that, you know, is it something that is genetic that is starting to show up? And I always recommend if you have a dog that has this type of behavior, and it usually starts showing up right around puberty, which I guess is when people start seeing it as well in the human world, you may want to consider getting them out of the gene pool just for the sake of the breed that you're dealing with.
What about picking? I wanted to talk a little bit about getting the right dog and choosing the right dog. I know you've had various experiences with people
Well, years of experience with new people coming in with their dogs. And two cases just recently came to mind of dogs that I think, you know, you start wondering who's to blame here. And unfortunately, both of them were Labrador Retriever, new puppies that were coming in. And I'm not saying that these labs were, you know, it was going to be a problem, but one was a single woman who is not capable of doing a lot of exercise, bought a dog. And when I always ask, well, why did you happen to pick this breed? And she said, well, I want a dog that likes to fetch so I can just sit and throw a ball and have them fetch the ball. And I want to have this dog be a therapy dog. I want to be able to take it into hospitals and so on. Well, the dog was a fairly out of control 8-week-old lab puppy, which is understandable. But by the time I saw this dog 4 weeks later, the dog was totally blind. The dog had an inherited ocular problem with its retina that it probably picked up from its mom and dad. And in questioning, yes, mom and dad were not evaluated prior to breeding them. It was just kind of a backyard breeding proposition. And, you know, and so there was somebody who bought a dog who had specific needs, but didn't look into what health problems does this dog have, and is the breeder I'm working with doing the right things by checking their dogs? And so anybody getting a dog really needs to do their homework and not just take the breeder's word for it. See the paperwork. You know, if they say, oh, no, we've never seen hip dysplasia, see that they've been checking in over the last few generations to make sure that the hips are good and their eyes are good and so on. The other dog was a beautiful Labrador retriever, but it was an elderly couple who had just lost another dog. They have an old lab that's arthritic and in his teens, and they went out and got this puppy. And the puppy is your typical jumpy, nippy, can't go to training class because the owners aren't capable of doing that. And the owners are getting physically traumatized to the point where they're getting tears in their skin and so on. Who do I blame for this? This dog came from good breeding stock. I blame the breeder. Why would they recommend this dog to a family like this? I mean, and I see both of these dogs potentially not being with the family in the next few months to a year, just because are the needs going to be able to be met? So, you know, you have to be smart about it. You've got to recognize your own lifestyle and your needs, but breeders need to be also, you know, very aware of where the dog's going to. And if somebody's willing to sell you a dog without grilling you, then, you know, maybe just walk away, because they're obviously in it for a buck and not for making sure that puppy is in a forever home.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Laura in Westfield, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a comment I'd like to make, please. I had a dog, and I'm a smoker, and I smoke pretty often. My dog had ended up with lung cancer. So secondhand smoke does affect dogs, too. I just wanted to make that comment. I'm not too sure, you know, maybe somebody doesn't know that.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of stuff that's been showing up recently. I mean, we know that especially for cats that groom themselves, we know that cats that come from homes with smokers have a much higher rate of gastrointestinal types of cancer because they're actually grooming the carcinogens off of their hair coat. We'll also see more oral cancers in cats from homes that are smokers as well. A higher risk of things like asthma. There has been a lot of debate whether nasal tumors and things potentially could be caused by secondhand smoke. I don't think it's been substantiated yet with good research. But yes, these are all things that we always have to be concerned about, not only for our own health, but for our pets' health as well. And so, you know, I always encourage people, if you are going to smoke and you have pets, you know, do it outside of the house. That's going to be the best way to be able to keep your pets healthy.
Yeah. And thanks for calling, Laura. Appreciate it, the comment. And Ron in Newburg, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Larry and Sandy, I called in last month with my story of my 8-year-old cat who stopped drinking water on June 7th of this year. And I've tried everything, your suggestions and other folks, well water, bottled water, flavor his water with clam juice or beef bouillon, put a stone in his water dish. He's got 3 of them plus a water fountain so that he can see the water level. Put a couple ice cubes in the dish and let it float around. That works once in a while. Let him sit on the bathroom counter while I brush my teeth. That works a little bit sometimes. The best one was to, for a week, sit on the floor near his water fountain and pet fits for 5 minutes. Finally, he gets up and walks over and puts his nose in and drinks for 2-3 minutes. But what connection does petting have to do with drinking water?
He wanted a dinner show.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going to a bar and having live music. There you go. You know, he got the entertainment he wanted and decided that, okay, well, they'll start drinking out of the water fountain. Believe it or not, I've had people with dogs doing, like, where I've had one family, this is a true story, two dogs that refused to eat unless the owner was sitting in front of both of them singing. And that was the ultimate dinner show, you know. And if she just sat there, they would just look at her. But as soon as she started to hum or sing, they would get right into eating and they would eat their food up. So it was a learned behavior that I have to have all these things in line before I can eat. So maybe they had a little bit of canine compulsive disorder as well. Who knows? But yeah, I'm glad your cat's drinking, because dehydration's not a fun thing to have to deal with.
No. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, you know, this tomorrow's National Pet Obesity Awareness Day, and related to that, we had a Facebook comment from Katie who says, my corgi is too fat. She's been mistaken for a piglet. I don't even know how to keep her on a leash. I've tried every imaginable kind. When I take her for a walk, she won't go. When she sees a squirrel or wants to greet a friendly neighbor, she slips right out of the leash. When I take her to the local dog park, she looks up at me as if to say, we must be here for your sake, because I have no interest in following that pack.
Yeah.
She'll run when she wants to run, but mostly she's more like a cat than a dog.
Yeah. You know, you have to find the right thing to work for your pet. When it comes, like, I have bulldogs that have those big bowling ball-shaped heads, and, you know, it goes right into from their head to their neck. And I've found that using a type of collar that has a small little slip loop in it works very, very well, rather than like a choker collar. Some dogs do better with harnesses, and there's one that is wonderful called the Easy Walker Harness that it's very difficult for the dog to be able to slip out of it. So this would be a chance to go to the pet store and get her fitted with something. Obviously, if you want her to lose weight, that's got a lot of adjustment to it, so that when she starts going down a few sizes, you can continue to use the device that you're using. But yeah, to get a dog to exercise, first of all, make sure that there isn't anything painful or physically wrong with your dog that could cause a problem, because sometimes we will see, I know corgis are one of the breeds that we see a lot of hip dysplasia in, believe it or not, even though they're a small, short-legged dog, we do see hip dysplasia in the breed. And it may be that when she's highly motivated to run after something like new people or a squirrel or whatever, she's very happy to do that. But roughhousing with a bunch of dogs at the dog park may be too uncomfortable for her. So before you start an exercise program, get her in for a good evaluation to make sure that there isn't anything there that needs to be treated to begin with. And once she's got a clean bill of health, you know, you're right, exercise is a big part of it, but I'd also be doing a diet assessment, looking at what food you're using. Bring in your measuring cup that you're using, the treats that you're giving. Really, really be truthful about the people food that you're using, so that, you know, we have a good idea of how many calories a day that she's taking in. And then we can do a calorie assessment to be able to figure out how many calories a day she actually needs. And, you know, it's kind of like us going to Jenny Craig. They tell you, here's your food. You know, you don't get anything more than this. And, you know, that's what's wonderful about pets, is that they can't open a can opener or go to the grocery store. So we're the ones that have to provide that for them. So, you know, by us being in control of the amount of food going in, then we're going to be able to start having some of those pounds slip off of her. I've had some dogs that, you know, you have to find out what motivates them. And if, you know, if it's chasing after a toy, or, you know, if it is, you know, going after squirrels, you may, you know, need to, you know, find, she may be a perfect dog to take up something like lure coursing. It's an event for dogs that like to go after things that move. You'll have to look up on YouTube or whatever and see videos of it. But they have a little thing that flutters on the ground that a lot of dogs likes to chase after. That may be a perfect event to get her enrolled in. And so finding out your closest lure coursing class, you don't have to have a squirrel for that. Obviously, they don't use live animals, but it's still extremely motivating for dogs that have that desire to chase. So that would be my advice. And it's not impossible. It's more of, you know, getting our mindset right that we can do this. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. You may have a question. Is your pet obese, or are you not sure? Have you ever seen signs of OCD in your pet. Those are some of the things we've been talking about. You can join in 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and post a photo as well of your pet. We'd love to see that. As a matter of fact, Jennifer sends some photos of her boyfriend's dog, Kramer, who's a cute-looking dog.
Oh, look at that. Nice pictures. Tilting his head to the side. He's really like a camera ham, isn't he?
Yeah. Kim in Mequon has a question for you. So let's even get to her. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Good morning. I just have a quick question. I have an 8-month-old golden retriever. Her name is Dorothy. And her brother happens to be in her same training class. And we saw him last Wednesday, and he just really did not look real hot, and we're all worried about him. And it was determined that he had twisted bowel and had surgery, and the thought was that it might be hereditary. So I'm wondering, is it hereditary? And if so, I guess that would be something that I would want to watch out.
Yeah,
Dorothy, because they're the same age and the same
right,
mom and dad,
right.
And all that.
Now, was it actually his bowels or was it his stomach?
Well, I only heard back from our trainer. I didn't talk to Murray's mom.
Okay,
but she had thought that it was twisted bowel.
Yeah, most dogs don't survive that. The bowels all hang from this real filmy, thin structure and it's attached to up by the backbone, and so they all kind of are, you know, hanging from this structure. And if you get a twist in the mesentery like that, that often cuts the blood supply off to a wide part of the bowel, and I don't know too many dogs that would survive that type of an injury. But we do see in deep-chested dogs twisted stomachs frequently. It's called gastric dilation and torsion. And that would be my guess as to probably what he had, just because it is much more common in the fact that he survived. And there's a number of risk factors for this. What we know is that if they are, eating a lot and exercising afterwards, drinking a lot of water and kind of getting, lots of water in, swallowing air for any reason. There's been some thoughts about, like stress and the type of food that you're using, like highly fermentable foods and so on. But one of the things that you may want to consider is if you are planning on having your dog spayed at some point in the near future, one of the things that the vet school offers is besides doing a standard spay, and you could do this along with the standard spay as well, they also do laparoscopic surgery where the ovaries are removed laparoscopically. And at the same time, you can elect to do what's called a gastropexy, which is where the stomach is tacked down to the abdominal wall. It doesn't prevent them from bloating, but it prevents the stomach from twisting, which is the more life-threatening version of this problem. So that, double check as to what actually happened to him. And if it was the fact that he did bloat and tore his stomach, then, consider doing one of those preventive measures that may be very helpful and actually save your dog's life down the road.
Yeah, she was already spayed a couple months, probably a month or so ago.
Okay.
No, probably a couple months. So,
but well, this can be done even afterwards. It's not a major, it is still abdominal surgery, but a fairly easy procedure to be able to do, especially if you're doing it laparoscopically.
Is it hereditary?
It doesn't tend to be hereditary. It tends to be more the way the dogs are shaped. The real deep, narrow-chested dogs are much more prone to this. And golden retrievers are right up there. I mean, we see some that are more barrel-shaped and some that are, kind of more slender chest. But any of the, the large breed deep-chested dogs can be prone to this.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Linda in Island Lake, Illinois, we turn to you next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just heard about that heavy set dog, but I just wanted to let that caller know if they check out Natural Balance, there's a fat dog formula sold at Petco. But my question is, my greyhound just turned 10, and she had a lump on her neck. And they took it out, and it was diagnosed to be lymphoma.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. I was told the options would be chemo and radiation, but at her age, I don't want to put her through that.
Yeah.
Quality of life. So yeah. I don't know if there's any alternative.
Well, you know, when we're doing chemotherapy on our patients, we are, it's very different, even though we're using the same drugs, it tends to be very different than the way they deal with it in people. And I wish I had an oncologist sitting here next to me because they could probably explain this a lot better. But what we're trying to do is give the dogs good quality of life for as long as we can. We're not usually looking for, if we get it, great, but we're not looking for full remission. And so we always weigh out the benefits of the drugs versus, you know, if they're going to make them feel sick or have some trouble. I mean, we, with the way our hair grows with chemotherapy, will lose hair. And yeah, there are some breeds of dogs, you know, that have the, you know, hair that continues to grow and needs to be trimmed that can lose hair and have hair coat changes. But for things like greyhounds, that may not be an issue. And the majority of dogs that go through chemo, if they don't mind going into the vet clinic, if, you know, and some dogs hate going into the vet clinic, and so it would be very difficult for them to be going in as often as they need to, you know, then you may want to consider thinking twice about it. But if the dog's, you know, happy with going in, that again may be something. Don't disregard it. 10 years old, I mean, we see a lot of greyhounds living much longer than that. I mean, we could still give her potentially, you know, another year or two, which would be 10 to 20% more of her life, which, you know, if that was a year or two for us, that would be not as much. But in her, that's a huge chunk of her life that you may be able to provide good quality of life for her. Your other alternatives, unfortunately, don't provide you with as much longevity. The other alternative, and we call it giving them a prednisone honeymoon, is treating them with a steroid, usually prednisone, that will shrink the lymph nodes down, make them feel good. But unfortunately, if you do that, then you can't go back and say, well, now that they're feeling good, I want to do chemotherapy, because it won't work as well. And, you know, the other issue is that it gives them that honeymoon for a matter of a few weeks. But I'm pulling this number out of my head, but you would think that, you know, within 6 to 8 weeks, they usually succumb to the disease. So it, again, it's just that, you know, it gives you time to be able to have good quality of life with her for a period of time before you finally have to make a decision. So before you just say no to chemotherapy, I would strongly recommend that you talk to a veterinary oncologist. We're really blessed in this state that we have not only private practice veterinary oncologists, but also you know, the whole department at the veterinary school that would be more than willing to work with you and your veterinarian to try to come up with a protocol that may be something that your dog would tolerate and provide your dog with good quality of life.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Good luck,
Linda. Thank you very much for calling. Always tough decisions.
You know, and I have two, like I said, my two bulldogs at home, and boy, we see a lot of bulldogs coming into the clinic with lymphoma, and, you know, I to the point where, even though they're not my patients, I recognize them by name and by, mm-hmm. by, oh, there he is, you know,
yeah.
and I know who they are.
Yep.
But, so I am, here's my compulsive disorder coming out, is daily, I'm not kidding. Instead of just petting them, I'm petting them and feeling all their peripheral lymph nodes.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Isn't that bad? But that's me as a veterinarian and knowing that the clock is ticking for my 10-year-old bulldogs. That is one of the things that they can get. So, but they enjoy it. They think I'm just giving them a nice massage. <Yeah.
laughs> Oh, man. Well, Sherry in Milwaukee also has a question for you. So we'll go to her next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Yeah, I a miniature pincher who is going to be 10 next week, and she is a diabetic. And the question, I guess, is the food. She's been diabetic for about two years,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, her blood sugar is pretty much controlled. She takes 13 units twice a day. But, you know, it was spiking at night. And so I started to investigate different dog foods, and I've heard all these different things like, you know, oh, she should have higher protein
oh, she should have more carbs. Then I read some stuff that say, oh, dogs and carbs is not the same as people and carbs. You know, it really needs to be more protein. So, and then also the timing of her shot, you know, give her a shot before the food, give her a shot after the food. So we're just at the point now of kind of reevaluating where we are, because I noticed when I give her the shots before the food, her blood sugar does go down.
Yeah.
Significant.
Yeah. So, we always recommend giving the insulin after they've shown us that they're going to eat. Because if you gave the insulin and she wasn't going to eat, now what are you going to do? It's going to drop her blood sugar, and she's not going to have any food there to get that blood sugar back up again. The diets that we usually recommend, and I think this may be you're getting confused about carbohydrates and fiber, okay, which is very different. High fiber diets are usually what's recommended for dogs that are diabetic. And the couple that are on the market, there's one that Nestle Purina makes called DCO, which stands for diabetes colitis, and I think the O stands for obesity. And like Hills makes one called WD. There's a number of different ones out there that would be therapeutic diets that would be recommended by your veterinarian. What that tends to do is slow the absorption of nutrients in the gut so that you get a more even, rather than getting this big spike right after a meal. If you've got a lot of easily digestible carbohydrates and so on, that's going to raise that blood sugar quite high. It's going to even things out a little bit more. I'm unsure like how you're managing your dog's diabetes. Are you doing your own home blood sugar evaluations?
Yeah. Well, I just want to mention with the food, she's now switched to Origin, a low glycemic index food for seniors, which is protein and pea fiber for fiber.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, no, she goes to the vet. She gets a glucose curve. She gets a fructosamine.
Okay.
She needs chiropractic.
Okay.
But at home, what I do is I use the sticks in the urine. So...
And you can't adjust your diabetes control with a urine sugar. You can't do that. Put those away. Okay. Don't even use those. What we've been teaching people to do is do their own home glucose monitoring on blood. There's a lot of little home monitoring units that just takes a tiny, not even a drop of blood, that you can either get from an ear margin, a foot pad. Most dogs tolerate it very well. We do it and cats tolerate it very well. You get a more accurate glucose measurement doing that than you would when you're doing it in the hospital if they're stressed. So that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about, because if she's all over the place and you're playing with the diet and it's spiking here and spiking there, then obviously she's not well controlled. And I think it's time to, you know, sit down and get a good every 2 hour, 24 hour glucose curve and just reassess everything. And this would be something you could potentially do at home.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck. Thank you, Sherry, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Anna in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Anna. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I do have a compulsive pet. I'm sorry to hear about all of the other pets, and I wish them well, but I have a cat who was adopted at 7 months old by my partner, and we now live together, and we have a younger cat, and they get along just fine. But when my partner leaves, he tends to get very compulsive and wanders around the house meowing, looking for her, but it's more than just a meow. It's almost like, it's hard to explain. He just gets very compulsive, and I try and comfort him, but he continues to do that, and I was wondering if there's anything I can do to help him feel relaxed when she's not there.
I think we're confusing some behavioral terms here, okay? When the compulsive disorders that we typically see in cats are either over-grooming, pulling their hair out after you've gone through an extensive rule out of medical problems. Sometimes we will see cats that there's a couple of other things that they can do. There's one that they call wool sucking, which isn't always wool, but they'll be like chewing on fabrics and actually ingesting them. Those are probably two of the big ones that we see in cats. cats, it sounds more like this kitty has an issue with what we call separation anxiety, which is, you know, where the cat is, you know, wandering around the house, very distressed. It would be similar to a dog sitting and just barking at the door because the owner walked out the door and they're all distressed. A couple of things I would try. One, they do make, if you're looking for non-medical interventions, there is something called the anxiety wrap for cats or the thunder shirt for cats, which is swaddles them, makes them feel sometimes a little more comfortable. They've been on the market for a few years for dogs. We now have them for cats. I'd also be looking at potentially plugging in some feel away, which is that facial pheromone that makes cats sometimes feel a little more relaxed and comfortable in their environment. And I'd also be working on when your partner is at home, teaching this cat that I can get up and walk out of the room and nothing bad's going to happen. So you start gradual departures. Again, looking, handling it just like we do in dogs, where you break down that departure into lots of little steps and gradually having your partner walk out the door and, you know, and then come right back in again because the cat's busy getting treats and is relaxed and happy, and gradually lengthen those departures. I would try that kind of stuff first before I'd be looking at medical management. But it may be that your kitty, that if the cat is, you know, really anxious during these episodes, you may have to have this kitty on some anti-anxiety medications. Unfortunately, nothing labeled for cat use. It's all human or canine medication that we're using. They all have kind of funky side effect profiles that we all have to address. And it sometimes can be stressful just getting the medication into the cat. And they have to be on it. It's not just something you use on an as-needed basis, but more on a, you know, an everyday basis if, when we're trying to get this problem under control.
Anna, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a Facebook question from Julie, who says, last Monday, my dog cried out in pain when reaching for a tennis ball. Tuesday, the vet recommended testing and immediate treatment for masticatory myositis, I believe.
Yes, you got it. Yeah.
Well, we are waiting for test results due on Friday. His prednisone was increased today because he's in more pain and running a fever, opening his mouth less. If there's no change, my vet may begin antibiotics on Wednesday in case there's some type of infection instead of the other. Any thoughts or suggestions? I've never heard of this condition before last week.
Well, it is actually fairly common. It's the muscles of mastication, the muscles used for chewing, come from a different embryologic origin than our other muscles in our body. And so they, even though they look like muscle, they act like muscle, the body recognizes them as very different than like your thigh muscle. And for some unknown reason, we'll start getting this autoimmune problem that's called masticatory myositis. You got it right, Larry, where the body starts attacking these muscles. It's like it's an immune response specifically directed at these muscles. The test that's being done is actually looking for an antibody level to the muscles of mastication. And I believe the only place that we can get it run is in California, and it does take a few days to come back. These dogs will come in. If you catch them early, the muscles of the face, they may actually feel swollen. They may be painful. Sometimes the dogs do have more difficulty opening their mouth. Often, though, owners and veterinarians miss that initial sign, and what we see is the aftermath. Once the immune system has started to work on those muscles, they can begin to atrophy. And we'll see these dogs come in with a very dished out skull. Instead of having like a soft, you know, squishy head, all you feel is bone. And it can get to the point where they may have trouble opening their mouth because now the muscles are fibrosing to the point where they have decreased range of motion. And so these dogs do need to be on drugs, sometimes steroids, and they have to be at immunosuppressive doses. So there's lots of side effects. But in other cases, we'll even have them on other immunosuppressive drugs as well to try to get this problem under control. So hopefully they'll get some answers. This is not an antibiotic responsive disease. And I think that would be, if that is their number one rule out, inappropriate use of an antibiotic. You know, if you're not treating an infection, don't just throw an antibiotic at a patient.
Yep, there we go. Pam in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, I was responding to the woman who called a few moments ago at the Greyhound with lymphoma. Our Siberian Husky 2 years ago was diagnosed with stage 3 mast cell tumors throughout his body, and we were given a day to decide whether we would treat with chemo or euthanize. And luckily, the UW Vet Clinic had recommended an oral chemotherapy that we were able to do at home.
Mm-hmm.
And we had amazing success. He had 9, probably 10 very healthy months. In fact, x-rays showed no signs of tumors within 3 weeks. And 2 additional months of decline towards the end. But he did get a very extended recovery out of it.
And this was mast
cell. Regrettably, I don't know excuse me.
Was this a mast cell tumor, you said?
It was. Yes.
Yeah, very,
they were very different from lymphoma.
Yeah, very different type of cancer than lymphoma. And, you know, mast cell tumors can often respond very well to oral chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when it comes to lymphoma, just because of the nature of cancer, oral therapy alone is probably not going to give the dog great quality of life very long. So just, again, different types of cancer require different medical managements. But I'm so glad your dog did so well for such a long period of time. You know, mast cell tumors are one of the most common tumors that we'll see in dogs. And I just had one in the other day that was a little dog that it was covered with these soft, squishy bumps that are normal in dogs called lipomas, benign fatty growths. But a new one had popped up kind of weird, kind of over the elbow, which was not a normal spot, but it still felt like a lipoma. And so I put a little needle in it, and sure enough, it was came back as a mast cell tumor. So, you know, and in that spot, that would be a really difficult one to be able to remove it with wide surgical margins, because it was kind of all wrapped around the elbow. And so oral therapy was something that was recommended. Sometimes in a place like that, radiation therapy is also something that would help shrink that mass down, which would then allow oral therapy to maybe be a little more effective.
Hmm.
So it all varies depending on age, location, type of cancer. That's why I'm not an oncologist. I just love the fact that they're just down the hall from me and I can just walk over and say, here's what I've got on my pathology report. What should I do?
There we go. Thanks, Pam, for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, we'll talk a little about the Affordable Care Act healthcare exchange. A week ago today, it opened amidst a very partisan government shutdown over the healthcare law. Kathleen Falk's going to join Kathleen Dunn to talk about the law and her new role as Region 5 Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's today at 2 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Right now, though, we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping our pets healthy and happy. Great to have her with us. Thank you so much for listening in. Our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've got some great photos. One, actually, of that Jeff sent us about his mini Aussie who loves to ride on the motorcycle.
And it looks like the dog's wearing dog goggles. And from it looks like it, too, it looks like he's kind of in a little basket or something on the back. So I'm having a hard time seeing that. But that would be my main concern is, you know, making sure the dog stays seated. I have known people with sidecars that have taken their dog and had them actually, you know, with a leash and so on. The doggles are a great idea. I don't know too many dogs that would wear head protection. but his question was on hearing. Probably not a big deal. I mean, I haven't heard anything about like dogs hanging their head out of the window in a car and having hearing loss. So I would doubt it makes any difference on a motorcycle.
And David sent a shot. A really cute shot here. We had an almost 2-year-old golden and got a new puppy buddy. Weren't sure how he would react, but was taken home less than 48 hours after The new puppy came home. They became good
and
buds.
They're cuddling up together. Oh my goodness, yeah. And that's it. You always get a new pet because you want to get a new pet, not because you think the other pet would want one. So yeah, but that's great that everything's worked out for them.
And Megan sent us a nice shot of Indy, seven and a half year old lab mix, who's enjoying laying in the sun this morning, enjoying the show.
Well, and we always feel guilty that, we have to leave the dogs. They should be the ones feeling guilty that we have to be out working for a living so that they can have those nice blankets and all those treats and great food.
Oh, man. Jody in Superior has a question for you. Jody, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I recently, about 2-3 weeks ago, went to our local animal shelter and adopted another dog. We already had two and decided to get a third one. They didn't have a lot of paperwork on the dog when I adopted her. And after a couple of days, I realized that there was something really different about her. So I went there and they did end up locating the paper. And I found out she's part blue heeler, which right there kind of raises a flag. But my question is about if there's any over-the-counter way in medicine or anything that I can use to calm her down. She is extremely hyper.
That's a tough one because there really isn't anything over the counter. And even if you were asking for a prescription drug like sedation, I'd be like, well, why? If she is a blue heeler cross, and you can do genetic testing if you wanted to, that those test kits are available. You can find out maybe a little bit more about her that way. They were bred to be working day and night. I mean, they are, your typical very driven dogs that need to have a job. And so you've only had her for a couple of weeks. And I'd have to say, well, what are you doing exercise-wise that is individualized to her so that she can burn off steam? I mean, do you run 5 miles a day with her? Do you have a field of cattle that she can herd? Do you, that may be the kind of exercise that you're going to be needing. When you're looking at over-the-counter calmatives, most of the ones that you're going to see available are going to be things like chamomile, hops, valerian, tryptophan. Like tryptophan we get from eating turkey, and it may make you a little sleepy after a big Thanksgiving meal, but you're going to be able to override that. Chamomile tea, yeah, may make you sleep a little bit better, but again, you're not going to be groggy. You'll still wake up if the fire alarm goes off. So, I don't know. I mean, when you're saying, sedation, if you're wanting a dog that is, out cold for whatever reason, you're going to have to work with your veterinarian to be able to find the right combination of drugs to use. But I think that would be an inappropriate use for maybe just a dog that is a little more dog than you were hoping for.
Right.
So,
I walk with her several times a day. We have other dogs that she can play with. We have a fenced-in yard, so she runs. I just want her to sit down and relax at about 7 o'clock at night. And she's just wound up.
Yeah, I don't look as walking as exercise for an active working dog. I mean, that is like taking somebody that is, runs triathlons and saying, let's go for a walk around the block. You're going to have to probably at 7 o'clock at night say, all right, let's go out for an hour's run. And you may have to take up jogging yourself or hire somebody that's an evening runner.
Biking.
Yeah. Those things that they call the springers that they make for dogs that hook to the back of the bike that would allow you to, run. She could run alongside the bike with you. That might be something to consider. They do make treadmills for dogs. Dogs will use human treadmills. You can train them to use that. And that may be perfect for her. She can be while your other dogs are settling down, running on the treadmill to burn off more steam. Oh, I'm just so glad I have bulldogs.
There we go. Thanks a lot. You mentioned treadmills, by the way, and I watched on the Big Ten Network the coach, the UW football coach, spent a day at the vet school.
He did. He got over his phobia of horses and dentists and all those things. And it was great. He spent some time with our physical therapy unit that has an underwater treadmill for
That's
dogs
what
to
I was
run
thinking
on.
About.
Right, right. And we use that for a lot of rehab work for dogs, and many dogs just absolutely love it. That water gives them a little bit of buoyancy, but also a little more effort to have to move against it. I get YouTube's videos sent to me all the time of dogs on treadmills, and it's amazing how many dogs absolutely love just running on a treadmill.
Yeah, that's great. Julie in Madison, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is actually a question that relates to the previous one, so it's a good segue. We adopted a dog from a rescue center in Milwaukee that came from the South, and he's about 14 months old now. He's a great mixed dog, probably setter and corgi, our vet thought. And he's very mild-mannered for the most part, but a couple months after we got him, he was diagnosed with heartworms, which apparently is common for dogs coming from the South. We treated him, and most of his, while he was on his heartworm treatment, he had to be sedentary. And so he's, as a puppy, that was kind of hard for him. But we basically kept him, we would take him on short walks, but we didn't let him run for about 2.5 months. And so now he's finished with his heartworm treatment and is mostly, completely actually better. But his behavior has changed a bit, so that when people he doesn't know come into our house, he's kind of aggressive.
Yeah.
Not to everybody, but it's sporadic. It's kind of erratic.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's related to having been cooped up, or when we let him out this weekend, we took him out to the North Woods, and he ran. He must have ran 50 miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Real active.
And it's probably totally unrelated to his heartworm disease. Heartworm are parasites that spread by mosquitoes, very common in the southern states, but getting to be more common as you move north. A really great website to go to is one called Companion Animal Parasite Council, CAPC.org. And on there, they will have what's called a parasite prevalence map. And anybody can go to this. And you can click on not only the country, but what state you want in the country, and then right down to the county and how many dogs tested positive for heartworm in those counties. Now, you're going to see some, like let's just say Mississippi, where there may be a county where there were no dogs tested positive. And it just may be that they were looking at data that came from a couple of outside labs where veterinarians send their blood work in for evaluation. And so it may be that the veterinarians in that area did their own in-house stuff, so it didn't get reported. But it gives you an idea of just how prevalent in some parts of the South, 1 out of 7 dogs is positive for heartworm. Up in the Dane County area where I live, it's about 1 in 230 dogs test positive for heartworm. And it's not a disease you want dogs to get, because as you found out, treatment is not just a matter of give an injection and you're fine. It's a very prolonged, as those worms are slowly dying. We need to keep those dogs often sedated in a kennel. I'm surprised that your vet even let them go out and walk. Usually we have them outside to go potty, right back in again and confined to a kennel. Mm-hmm. It may be the fact that he is now acting weird around new people. It may be just a function of the fact that he's now feeling more comfortable in your home. It may be that this was something that, because he hasn't been over the last few months well socialized, I'd strongly be recommending that you work with an animal behaviorist, actually have someone come to your house and see how he's reacting. Is he fearful? Is he, being, really territorial, and give you pointers as to how you can deal with this. But make sure he's kept on his heartworm preventative, and thank you for adopting this dog. And
yeah,
big
he's
issue,
wonderful.
Yeah,
we love him. So.
And make sure you do go back, because that day that he got tested for heartworm was looking at what he got exposed to 6 or 7 months previously. And so just don't assume that one treatment that you did is going to be enough. He may need to be treated again. And so be looking at from the day he was diagnosed, get another test done in 6 or 7 months to make sure that he truly is negative.
Mm-hmm. Can I have a follow-up question for that? Do you know where I can find a behavioral person who can help one-on-one? I've tried calling a number of places.
Yeah. I mean, there is a veterinary association called AVSAB, American Veterinary Society for Animal Behavior, and they have people listed there that are board-certified animal behaviorists in the veterinary world. But you also want to be looking for an applied animal behaviorist. And locally here in our area, we have several people. One group is Dog's Best Friend, and, you know, they do house calls, but you don't want to be working with just a trainer. You want somebody that is well-versed in behavior modification.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Facebook question from Diana. I have a 10-year-old, 10-pound cat whose nails we can't clip. She struggles so much. Could I give her Benadryl or a Dramamine beforehand?
You could, but she'll probably override it. Yeah. I strongly recommend learning how to burrito your cat, getting them wrapped up in a towel the right way so that the cat is well confined and you can just pull out one leg at a time and get the cat, you know, comfortable with having its feet touched. That way you save your own hide and you can get the job done.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're getting some great photos on my Facebook page, and I hope you'll keep them coming. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, post your photo, and please go and take a look at the photos. There's some wonderful shots there. And call with your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her with us as well. You have a question? Join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page and post your question there or your photo there. Or if you don't have a question or a photo, just go to the page anyway, because there are lots of great photos up there right now of pets that people have posted. Just it's at the Larry Mueller Show. And Sandy, there's Alan sent us a photo of a rescue Sheltie.
With a funky toe.
With a funky toe, and includes a picture of the...
Yeah. He says it's one of the second digits on the foot, and I think I said second digit.
Yeah.
But so when I initially looked at it, I was thinking, okay, maybe that's a dew claw, one of those little extra toes at the side of the foot that is often removed by the breeder or veterinarians when puppies are little. And if you don't get all the nail tissue removed at that point, sometimes even months or years later, you may get a weird kind of ingrown nail growing out. But when it happens on one of the other toes, that is very typical for a dog that's injured the nail bed. I can point to a couple of my own fingers where I've damaged my nail and now I've got ridges. It cracks more easily because of past damage. This is what happens with the dog when they've had an injury to the nail bed. So at one point, the dog may have either, you know, traumatized the nail bed without causing the nail to actually fall off. But now as the nail grows, it's more twisted and thickened. The only thing you can do is either just keep this trimmed, and it may mean, because it's more difficult to trim, using something like a Dremel tool to keep it ground down. The other option would be to do a toe amputation. Take that nail producing tissue actually originates from the last bone in the toe, and actually removing that like you would with declawing a cat. And so that's major surgery. Obviously, I would just be recommending trying to keep it trimmed if possible.
Peg in Rice Lake has a question for you. Hi, Peg.
Hello there. Are you with me?
Yes. What can we do for you?
I have a 20-year-old cat named Suki Caboodle. She is a beautiful cat, a beautiful, sweet little cat. And she's been doing really good. She's so thin it hurts to look at her. But she's otherwise okay, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she goes outside with us sometimes and she walks around the house, and she checks when somebody comes to visit, and et cetera. So I'd like to keep her remaining months or years, whatever it is, as comfortable as possible.
Mm-hmm.
She has been tested, and she is hyperthyroid.
Okay.
And I was given a diet for her. It was a prescription diet.
Yeah.
Which she will not touch.
Yeah. Many cats, there is a diet. What that diet is one that Hills makes. It's called YD. They ran out of letters, and they were coming up with all the letters, because they use letters for all the different disease treatment foods. But it's an extremely iodine-restricted food. And that when the cat is going to be treated with that, that's all they can eat. They can't get a treat. They can't get any human food. They can only get that diet. And I have personally not used it, because just looking at the diet profile, it just is not suitable for a cat that is in the state like you're describing Suki to be, being very, you know, very, very thin. So my preference would be to use a medication that would help control her thyroid level. And the drug that we use is called methimazole, or tapazole is the brand name of it. And fortunately for... Pardon me?
It's called tapazole.
Tapazole. And your veterinarian, if you can just ask your veterinarian that for the medication rather than the food, you can get this medication in a gel form that you just put on a part of the body that the cat can't groom, usually the inside of the flap of the ear. It's typically used twice a day, but it will require some drug monitoring initially when you get started on using something like that. So that would be my recommendation, is rather than letting her, you know, continue to lose weight and potentially go into heart failure with her hyperthyroidism, you know, get her treated with something like this. And it does mean going back in a few times to make sure that we're not affecting anything else with that particular drug and that we've got her on the right level. But it's easy enough to use. You can get it in a pill form as well if you think you can pill her. But I just find that many owners find that the gel is so much easier to use, because you just have to apply it to their skin.
There you go, Peg. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Jerry in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon. I have a cocker poodle mix, and he's about 6 years old, and we take him to the groomer about every 2 months or so. And anyways, after she gets done, she also excretes his glands, and he was full last week, and we're just going to take him again this week to get his hair cut.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that he, if you see any problems with him biting or licking,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't scoot across the floor. He just, you know, licks.
Yeah.
To bring him back in, and she'll secrete him again on that. But why, is there a diet, something to do with the diet, or what can be
very
done?
Very unlikely. It may just be individual dog anatomy. I would also be asking your groomer how she expresses the anal glands. Most groomers do not do a rectal. For cats, you can do them externally, but for dogs, it is important that a rectal is done to be able to express them correctly. If she's squeezing from the outside, that may increase the pressure in the gland, and it's because of the dog's anatomy and the way the ducts are located. And that can actually aggravate those anal glands, get them inflamed, make it harder for him to secrete his own discharge. And so it can just be a vicious cycle. I wish groomers would just lay off doing anal glands. Sorry, groomers out there, but unless you're doing a rectal, don't touch those anal glands, okay? I know owners expect you to do it, but I think often that can cause more problems for the dog in the long run. I would be recommending that before you go to the groomer, go into your veterinarian, have them expressed the appropriate way rectally, have the, you know, let the veterinarian see the consistency of the discharge, if it expresses easily, or whether that duct has now been scarred down enough that it's more difficult for the dog to be able to get that material out. If there's any signs of infection, obviously get it treated appropriately, maybe infusing the gland, oral antibiotics, and so on. But that's the way I would be directing this. We have tried, and I will do this even though I've not found much success, is say, you know, putting the dog on a real high fiber diet so that they've got big, bulky stools and they're defecating more frequently during the day. A lot of the high fiber foods, you may find that the dog may have 4, 5, 6 BMs a day. And since passing stool is what kind of squashes the gland and allows it to expel its contents, that may help a little bit with getting them emptied. I've not had great success when we've had dogs that have had scarred down ducts or signs of anal gland infection. But don't go to the groomer. Go to your vet first. If your vet says, no, they express really easily, you know, you just barely have to touch them and the stuff comes out, then maybe the groomer is able to do them. But that's just kind of my pet peeve. And
okay.
I'll let you deal with the consequences after that.
Thanks for calling, Jerry. Good luck. Kara in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi to you.
Hi there. I have a dog. He's 4 years old. He's a Boxer Lab mix. We got him from a rescue. When he was a puppy, we have cats and we play with the laser pointer, and we noticed he was following the laser pointer. And we stopped doing that because it's gotten to the point of obsession with anything that reflects on a wall, be it a cell phone, a watch, just some sort of light. And he's almost obsessed with it when he sees it. And I'm just wondering if that's an issue, how we can stop him from doing that, or if it's just nothing to be worried about and let him.
Yeah, it's actually one of the more common compulsive disorders that we see in dogs. I used to have a bulldog many years ago that all she had to do was hear the click of the laser pointer and she'd be in a dead sleep. She would wake up. I mean, she one time was so upset. I was just using it around the room. She knocked a recliner chair over. She jumped on it, reclined it, knocked it over to continue to jump at the wall behind it. And so, you know, it can get to the point where, you know, the dog's to the point of exhaustion if you're overdoing it. Can you do it? Yeah, maybe, you know, if the dog really finds joy in it and it's a, you know, way of getting a little bit of exercise. I can tell you that when my dog that was obsessed with the laser pointer, I would stand out on my back deck. I had a 2-acre yard and I would just shine that laser pointer from one end of the yard to the other. And she just ran back and forth and back and forth. Hey, maybe that'll help that corgi that needs to lose weight.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, you know, is it a problem? It all depends. If the dog is spending then hours just staring at that blank wall, waiting for that light to appear, now you've got an issue. But if they go back to their normal life again and they're like, okay, I'll just be a normal boxer and play with my toys and do everything and, you know, run to the door when the doorbell rings, then you probably don't have a problem. The dog's controlling it and it's just more like a hobby. But I'd have to get a little more information before, you know, we know for sure. But it can definitely control a dog's life.
Thanks.
And so you have to be careful.
Thanks, Kara. Stanley in West Dallas. Hi.
Hello there, Larry and Shelby. Talking about heartworms, I give my dog HeartGuard Plus.
Mm-hmm.
I've been giving it to her for, well, she's 9 years old, so I've been giving it to her for a long time. But anyway, the last time I took her to the vet was in March. I take her every 6 months. And I just had, today I took out her statement from March because she has to go to the vet again, and I'm looking at it, and they gave her a heartworm test.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, if I'm giving her HeartGuard Plus, why do I have to have her tested?
Are you using it year-round?
Every month.
Every month. So you're using it year-round. Great. That's the national guidelines, is to use it year-round. And this is a really terrific question because a number of things have come up. I can tell you with my own case, I was vacuuming under the couch one time and found a heartworm pill. So here I am, a veterinarian that tends to be fairly good about medicating their pets, although I have to admit I didn't give it on October 1st. I gave it on October 5th this year because I forgot. Mm-hmm. And so you can be a couple of weeks late and the heartworm preventative is still 100% effective. It's just easier to remember to do it every 30 days than to, you know, be doing it later. And so sometimes pills get missed. One of our pharmacists actually told me their story. They gave their dog one of the HeartGuard chews. And the reason why we call them chews is they are meant to be chewed. And if the dog swallows it whole, sometimes that medication may not leach out of that tablet. And that happened with her dog. She was out in the backyard picking up fecal material. And there was the HeartGuard cube. And what did she do? wash it off and feed it to her dog again. So mistakes happen. We may miss on giving pills, but probably the other two big reasons for this area, why we do it, is the majority of veterinarians are doing a heartworm test now that is called the 4DX test. It's a heartworm test, plus it looks at the top three tick-borne diseases. And what I tell my clients is that, yeah, you can use heartworm preventative year-round, but I want to do a tick screen on your dog. And guess what? I can't separate out that heartworm component. So we're going to get that along with it, because we see definitely more dogs exposed to tick-borne diseases in this area than we do heartworm. But the other main reason is, and it's not in this area, but they have identified in some areas of the South, there have been patchy areas where we have dogs that are carrying heartworm that are resistant to every heartworm preventative that's out there. So we have populations of heartworm now that we don't have ways of treating. And it, you know, when is that going to end up coming up in our area? I have no idea. But one of the theories is that if you have a dog with low level of heartworm and they're living with their heartworm disease and you're just monthly blindly giving them a heartworm pill, that maybe just constant, that low level exposure of the preventative, which will not kill adults by themselves, you know, it may happen after months and months and months and months of use, but it can help them develop some resistance. And so that is what is going on in our country right now. And I don't even want to think about what's going to happen if we've got heartworm that we have nothing we can treat it with, because it's a horrible disease to have to treat. And so that's one of the other reasons why they're strongly recommending surveillance. Again, not so much in this area, but if you live down south and we get people listening to our show all over the place, you really have to test. And sometimes they're even recommending in some parts of the heavy heartworm areas twice a year testing. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Stanley, for calling. Appreciate it. Ken and Mercer, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old yellow lab named Bird Dog. He was vaccinated for Lyme disease. Then he got Lyme disease. And I'm wondering if the antibodies are finally in his blood, or is he eligible for it a second time?
So when you said he got Lyme disease, was he clinical for it? Did he have lameness, fever, you know, really feeling bad? Or was it just the test came back positive?
So the test came back positive.
Okay.
And we put him on, I think it was doxycycline.
Okay.
And then, you know, I could actually, you know, maybe I just didn't notice the symptoms, because when he first got it, he was a fairly young dog. And
okay.
Maybe I didn't notice it, and he didn't seem, but when he got cured, supposedly, he was fine and spry and a great dog.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I
think with doxycycline being in such short supply, the veterinarians are now kind of, we're instead of just treating a lab test, we have to treat patients. And so when we get a positive back, what that tells me is the owner should be watching for signs of lameness and fever and the classic signs. We usually screen for evidence of Lyme nephritis, which is a kidney form that is kind of unique to dogs. Checking for that, which is an easy urine test to be able to do. We look for protein in the urine. But we usually don't treat just a positive unless they are actually showing some symptoms or have some kidney indications or something like that. The vaccine is not 100% effective. And so, what this tells me is that you are dealing with a dog that's probably in a has a lifestyle or a home environment that's putting them at much higher risk for picking up Lyme, a heavy deer tick population. I did, in fact, posted in our exam rooms, we have little calendars looking at November, December, January, and February of last year. And every single one of those months, we had temperatures that would support deer tick activity, even if there was snow on the ground, because the weather got to be above freezing in that 34, 35 degree weather. They will come out of even snow-covered ground and quest on the end of dried grass blades and branches. So people that stop using their tick preventative when there's snow on the ground are putting their dogs at risk. And so we are in an area where we need 12 months of tick control a year, 12 months a year. We don't need 365 days of tick control, but we need 12 months, because there are days where we don't need it, but it's hard to predict what those days are going to be. Yeah. So keep your dog on it year round. And I would still be, this is controversial, considering vaccinating your dog for Lyme disease, continue on doing it because your dog is obviously at very high risk. There are some groups of veterinarians that are like, well, should we vaccinate? Is it potential for, you know, causing worse disease? The verdict isn't in yet, okay, on that. So I'm one that says go ahead and vaccinate. But that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about, but use year-round tick control.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had Lynette emailed us her 38-pound boxer cattle dog mix ate a mushroom in the yard and within minutes was drooling like a St. Bernard and then became lethargic about 3 hours, you know, finally came back after about 3 hours, but... you know, you have to be kind of careful about that.
Yeah, we just had a puppy in this weekend that ate a bunch of mushrooms. And the owner reported that, you know, she went out and surveyed her backyard and was looking to see, you know, what mushrooms are out there. We don't have a whole lot of toxic mushrooms in the state. But, you know, again, this would be something that a mycologist may be able to, I think that's what they're called, mycologists.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Be able to give the owner some idea if you can identify what mushrooms you have in your area, whether they're safe or not. But this just goes to show you that when we have pets that eat things indiscriminately, having on at home some peroxide to be able to force vomiting. I mean, obviously, talk to the veterinarian first, call an animal control or a emergency center and make sure that the toxin that they've swallowed is a safe one to have them bring up, because there's some that are caustic that we don't want to do that with. But having some 3% hydrogen peroxide around, the dose for dogs is a milliliter per pound of body weight. So that means a teaspoon for every 5 pounds. And the maximum amount would be 45 mils, okay, which is 9 teaspoons. Okay, so if you've got a dog that is, you know, a good-sized dog, you don't want to give anything more than 45 mils. And you can repeat it again 10 to 15 minutes later. If you can't get your dog to vomit, it's time to go into the clinic. But that is something to have at home.
All right, there we go. Looking at some more pictures on my Facebook page, Sherry sent a great one of Mickey, whose favorite thing is to go out for a paddle in the canoe.
And look, he's wearing a life jacket. So wonderful, because even dogs that are strong swimmers, if they get caught under that boat, if a big wave hit the boat, or they're far from shore, that could potentially be a problem. So I like to see that dog wearing a life jacket.
And the person, too.
Oh, and the person, too. Definitely. Yes.
And another cute picture of Bitsy. That's, oh, what a pretty dog, from Tracy.
Yeah. Looking out the window and surveying the neighborhood. And the way the dog's sitting, I wonder if it's got bad hips or knees. Like, it's kind of, that's what I see when I see the picture.
Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. She'll be back next month, and we will do this all over again with her, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. From the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, she'll be back on November 12th, Tuesday, November 12th. Coming up at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, we'll bring you NPR special coverage of President Obama's press conference. We expect him to talk about the government partial shutdown and the upcoming debt ceiling deadline. That's the president's press conference coming up at 1, right after a chapter a day here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow on the program, Phil Pelletieri joins us to talk about the world of insects. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.